cannot believe what has become of me in 2020.
What's wrong, Brad? You sound glum.
I don't know if glum is the right word.
You sound despondent due to the existential crisis of being in the time of coronavirus.
It's the existential crisis of becoming a middle-aged fan / obsessive of Minecraft.
Ooh, I play a shocking amount of Minecraft these days, too.
Yeah, it's for all ages. That's what I like to say. Are you familiar with Optifine?
No. The texture pack thing?
It's kind of more of a graphics framework. It's like a massive like tweak pack for Minecraft for like graphics options.
But you just actually'd me there, but okay.
No. I'm trying to layer it up so you have a fun. Like, dude, this podcast is all about obsessively understanding to an excessive amount of detail how things work.
I apologize for shaming you.
I just like to spread as much knowledge as I can.
No, I love that. Okay, so what's Optifine?
Optifine, I mean, it doesn't make Minecraft really look any different. It is a bunch of optimizations and tweaks for different stuff that like it increases the frame rate a lot and gives you a bunch of options. But then the shader packs that you're talking about are made by other people. And they're layered on top of Optifine. It's like a framework that enables that stuff.
On my computer, Minecraft runs, I have to run VSync so that my computer doesn't sound like a jet engine because Minecraft will run at like 600 frames a second or something.
Yeah, so this has a lot more tweaks for stuff like that. Like, even if you're not going to use shader packs, it's worth installing just to get a bunch of extra options for enabling and disabling stuff. But the really nice looking, like that path tracing mod that made a bunch of news a few months ago.
Yeah.
Remember? Like that runs on Optifine. It's made by Sonic Ether, who was a different guy, but it is enabled by. Anyway,
you're talking about Java Minecraft.
Oh, did I need to specify?
I play the kid version of Minecraft because I play with my kid.
Sorry, this is a.
Yeah, I'm a Bedrock man now.
This is a different world.
I can't do mods because of the Windows application framework. Unfortunately,
that's one of numerous reasons that we're still using the Java version. Anyway. I got really into Minecraft shader packs.
Okay.
For about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1.16 came out.
Oh, yeah. You got the Nether now.
And I traded in my fancy graphics for a Nether update. I was not aware that mods, every new version of Minecraft breaks all the mods and you have to wait for them to be updated.
Yep. That's why the kids all play Bedrock, because then they don't have to fool with that.
Like, all I'm trying to tell you is that I got the sweet taste of Ambrosia for about 6 days with, I wasn't even using the path tracing mod because I don't have an RTX card, but I don't think it's required actually to have an RTX card, but I don't think it runs very well. I was using just his previous texture pack or shader pack, but it looks so good, dude. It's like literally one of the best looking games I think I've ever seen with that shader pack installed. Huh. And I had it for about 6 days and then the update came out and now I can't use it anymore. And I am obsessively refreshing the Twitter account for Optifine every day now.
So I have a different Minecraft problem. My problem is that now, because I haven't played a whole lot in the last two or three updates, and my daughter is playing every day with multiple friends, and like they have older siblings and they're learning new things constantly, she's now teaching me how to play Minecraft.
Dude, you got to go where the knowledge, like I just said, you just look to increase your own knowledge from people who know. And if that's your daughter.
Yeah, she's like, Dad, soul lights are actually brand new and you can use them to create a blue light source in the world. And I was like, oh, I like blue lights. That's much better than red. Wait, no, blue lights are going to keep me awake. Don't put the blue lights in here.
You don't refine the netherite. You apply it to diamond material, Dad.
Man, I wish I could refine the netherite. I'm kind of excited. I kind of want to go do an adventure. I want to do a Minecraft adventure where we just like don't build and like have like dungeon crawl in Minecraft.
Yeah, that would be so. We've got this 6-person server running that we've been doing streams with, and I feel like it's kind of run out of steam. People are sort of hitting a wall of creativity, like not really sure what to do next. My idea is to we're doing a whitelist situation, so only the 6 of us can get on there.
Yeah,
my idea is to whitelist another 6 people,
ooh,
and let them go build a fort somewhere else
and have a war,
and then have a war. That's what I want to do with that server. I don't know what a Minecraft war would look like, but.
So watching kids play with Minecraft obviously we do Bedrock because most of her friends are playing on like tablets and switches and stuff like, I mean, she plays on a Switch. So that like being able to play regardless of what console you have is an incredibly powerful thing. Cause that doesn't work for any other game that the kids are interested in playing.
Sure.
And they do like play dates where at 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. There's a spreadsheet and you put your name in and those people fill the 10 slots on the server and they get in and they like, some of them are building and some of them are exploring and some of them are mining. And like the big kids are teaching the young kids how to make secret doors and stuff like that. And it has been a powerful force for good and social interaction in an otherwise dark time.
Here I am over here trying to turn Minecraft into a battlefield and the kids are focusing on the collective good. It's just another example of the children being our only hope.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
It's another morning pod, Brad.
I think I'm coming to prefer the morning pods to the evening pods, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, it depends on how,
how morning?
In the morning, you start at a base level.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the end of the day, like the days could have gone one of three or four different ways. Yeah.
Yes, that's a good point.
Yeah,
there's a certain predictability to your morning. Like, you know, there's a little ramp up. But once you ramp up, you're there versus sometimes the evening. There's nothing left.
Last night ended with me calling vast swaths of America idiots on Twitter. And people took that really personally. I was kind of surprised.
I bet.
Yeah.
That's why, I get it.
But you know what? They didn't take personally.
What's that?
Emails.
Oh, yeah. No, emails are for everybody.
No, everyone loves emails.
Everyone loves and hates emails equally, I find.
I forgot to talk about it in the check-in, like the project check-in patron exclusive episode of Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod that was released last week. But I paid for Hey. I decided to keep it.
Oh, yeah.
It's good.
Hey.
I like it.
Hey.
The thing I looked at was at $100 a year, if I catch one email that I would have missed, that's like the smallest possible amount of money people would want to pay me to do work, then it paid for itself.
Man, you're getting that many emails from people who want you to do work.
I get a lot of like, hey, I need somebody to consult on this thing, but I can only pay you for like a half day.
Okay.
Which is like a few $100.
Sure. Well, that's more than the Hey subscription, apparently.
That covers the Hey subscription.
That's just math. That's good business sense.
Yep. So there we go. Hey.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Hey, speaking of housekeeping, did you want to talk before we get into these emails about browser plugin ad stuff?
Yeah, we when we did the security episode a few weeks ago and talked about ad blockers and pie holes and things like that, we recommended a bunch of ad blocker plugins, and all of the ones we recommended were bad for reasons we don't need to get into, either just selling data or just.
Ooh,
like, or they're charging for things that they shouldn't be charging for, or they're icky in general. The industry recommended ad blocker for your browser right now, which should work in conjunction with a pie hole to make you super safe and secure, is uBlock Origin. That's the one everybody seems to like. And they don't seem to be selling their stuff. If I would strongly encourage you, if you like uBlock Origin and you use it, to pay them money, because if you don't, then they will have to start selling your data in order to keep making the product that you use every day. So somebody's got to get paid somewhere. That's the secret of ad tech.
Yeah. And again, Firefox will do some amount of that stuff, right? Built in.
Well, Firefox will silo social media cookies and tracking stuff in their own like fenced containers.
Yeah, supposedly the new Edge will also do some of that stuff.
Yeah, on Firefox, I think it's installed by default on new installs, the Facebook container. But if you have an old install, you may have to install it manually from the extension store.
I want to say I saw a toggle work its way into Chrome recently, although I can't find it right now for something along the lines of like, hey, withhold certain cookies or something like that. Like it just seems like privacy and blocking are becoming a must-have feature in browsers. I think
People are worried and concerned about that stuff in ways that they have not been up until this point.
Yes. So, all right. Well, good to know.
My boat, my neighbor's boat just started. So
what is
if
it
I can't with, edit even, this out,
you don't
I
even
apologize.
Live close enough to water for that to, what is, I don't understand.
So
are they working on the boat?
Yeah. Like when you take the boat so they go camping every year and take the boat with them. And when they de-winterize it and get it ready to, having owned a boat in the past and done this work myself, when you take it out for the first big trip of the year, you have to like make sure it runs and change the oil and all of the things, you know, de-winterize the block so that if it froze, it didn't crack and all that stuff.
It's like
so
outboard motor kind of situation.
No, this is like a 28 foot inboard outboard. Hmm. You know, it's a recreational boat. It's not like a fishing boat. It's not like a tour boat. It's nothing huge. It's yep. They tow it with a pickup truck.
Okay.
But you know, it's time. We didn't do it last week because we're bad at calendars. And also the Apple stuff happened and we wanted to talk about that, but it's time for emails.
Yeah. Got a bunch.
And I think inspired by, well, it's probably specifically because we asked for them after our tech horror story episode a couple weeks ago. We got a boatload of people sharing their worst mistakes.
Yeah.
Which has been really entertaining. So I think we should read some of the better ones.
Get into some of those first.
Yeah. You drive. I'm just here. I'm just here drinking tea.
All right. Let's see what we got here. Remind me this is partially housekeeping and partially because I can never remember myself the email address.
Email address is techpod@content.town.
Yes, got it.
techpod@content.town.
I will never forget that again. I promise.
It's, you know, Brad, it's the URL for the podcast also.
Sure.
techpod.content.town.
It's almost like you designed it that way.
I mean, yes. Totally intentional decisions.
Everything we do is 100% intentional and very well thought out. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll read some emails here. Let's start with a couple of horror stories, I guess. Here's one from Christian in Norway.
Hello, Christian.
I have two stories, one IT related and one just in general biggest mistake. A decade ago, I worked IT at a hospital. It was just regular support. And one day one of the client guys was to push a new Ethernet driver to a specific computer model. You might guess where this is headed. We started getting a few messages about people losing network connections and being unable to work. It spread quickly and it turned out he had not defined the scope correctly when pushing the driver. So he hit not only the model he wanted, but also quite a few other computers as well. I do not recollect specifically, but I believe we were talking 200 or 300 computers down. Everyone in the department ran from the apprentices up to the boss. We had drivers on a stick and just jumped from computer to computer with the problem and managed to solve it within a few hours. Just as a side note, working IT in a hospital is quite a special thing. I've been in elevators when crash carts were pushed in with doctors sitting on top doing CPR while they were rushing to the emergency room. I've been called into operating rooms during major operations when things stopped working. I've fixed computers when hearing women screaming next door giving birth.
Do you think you have to scrub up to go into the operating room to fix a computer in the operating room?
I think absolutely. About that, but I would say, you know, what is the downside of making them do that?
Probably. Like, I wonder if you have like an autoclaved screwdriver to go in and open up the hardware. I want to know what the protocols are there.
Oof, yeah. Better safe than sorry is what I would assume.
Yeah, like if it's like a hip surgery, a hip replacement where they have to wear the bubble domes to keep from aspirating little bits of bone. I wonder if he has to wear the bubble with the rest of I have this email is making many more questions.
Yes, you got to observe proper procedures. And then here's the second half. on to my costliest failure. Before I went into IT, I was working as an electrician in a large refining plant. This is while I was still an apprentice. In such large companies, there is an unofficial million club where the members are those that have caused stops in the plant that cost the company more than $1 million.
Oh, my God.
To be fair, due to currency conversion, that would be more like $100,000. But still, normally this is just downtime of 30 to 60 minutes before you hit a threshold like that. You know where this story is going as well. We were out doing some small work, just changing some sensor cables. A wire running to an LED lamp and things like that. But everything is connected, so if a signal from a sensor is not working anymore, everything can stop. We usually like this because it makes things safe, right? He sent a picture along to illustrate it. It's just a gigantic patch cable or patch panel type thing with just a million cables coming out of it. I was told to unscrew a cable at the top row of a clamp, but loosened the bottom side, pulling out the wire. and dead silence. You hear room after room, machine after machine, floor after floor stopping. My boss quickly understood why. We connected the cable, sent a message to the control rooms that they could start up again. I was feeling like shit and got a clap on the shoulder and welcome to the Millium Club and a grin.
Wow.
Yeah, that would be a bad feeling, I guess. I don't know. That's, I wonder if maybe that stuff is so complicated that you don't suffer serious repercussions by screwing up like that.
I mean, you think about that, but then also, well, I mean, look, human mistakes happen constantly, right?
Yeah.
But like, have I wasted $1 million worth of company money having meetings with too many people that went on too long over the 20 years that I've been working in an office? Probably.
Yeah, but that's a soft kind of waste that the middle management can very easily overlook or sweep under the rug, true, or pretend doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Or justify.
Yeah.
You know, a full shutdown of production is a lot easier to quantify, right?
Yeah. I always wanted to yell stop the presses. You know, it's like the Gonzo joke from one of the Muppet movies. I don't remember which one, but
sure.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be fun until all the paper comes unspooled and you have to rethread the entire gigantic printing press.
Run around wearing a fedora with a press card in it.
That one's a, yeah. I was pissed when I started as a journalist that I didn't get a fedora with a press card. Have you ever had a press card?
No.
They don't give press cards to people.
Convention badges and wristbands and stuff like that. No, it's not the same.
I found out that, like during the BLM protests, which obviously are still ongoing, that people who were local, like reporters in New York and Minneapolis and places like that, had actual press cards that were issued by the city. I was like, what? Really? That's amazing. I want one of those.
Sure. I don't know if there's very much that's enviable about what those people are having to go through right now, though. But
I mean, the reporters are just, you know, they're doing reporting and
Doesn't sound like they're having the best time of it either, but
no, it's not a good time for anybody. But
all right. Here's another story. This one is from Kat. At the time of the story, I was a brand new, about 3 months in, level one tech at a public school system. I was directed to remove a couple of desktops out of a computer lab to be allocated somewhere else in the district. Anyway, I'm in the lab and removing the desktops, and I'm admiring the neatly bound Ethernet and power cables from my predecessor. I'm not as neat and didn't want to unbundle some of these cables, so at one point I had an extra end to an Ethernet cable and I didn't know where it terminated to. I didn't know any better, so I just plugged all the Ethernet ends into the wall and went about my day.
Oh no.
I'm curious about the background of this problem. Maybe you'll have some insight here. Not long after the network slowed and ground to a halt, my director and systems admin were frantically trying to figure out what happened, because the network for the entire town all pointed to our server room at my school. This was the newest building with all new servers, fiber connections, etc. It was also bad because my systems admin had taken a sick day and had to get called in to troubleshoot the issue, but it was a Friday afternoon, so the students were thrilled and the staff were over it. I went home and didn't think much of it. At some point the next day during a drive, my husband, who also works IT, much more knowledgeable than I, was explaining that it sounded like a network loop. I thought that was plausible and then realized that it was me after I left that afternoon. After I left that afternoon, my sysadmin and director traced the loop to the ports, and my director realized that I did it. Monday morning, I rushed into the school and checked the lab and noticed that the Ethernet was unplugged. My director was not mad, and he covered for me to my superintendent about the incident. My sysadmin wasn't mad either, because we supposedly were paying for a system to prevent loops, and clearly it wasn't working. He said I exposed a vulnerability and that he was grateful for it. So within my first 90 days, I brought down an entire school district and all the town offices on a Friday afternoon, and I'm still employed. Valuable lesson learned. I wonder, both from a kind of network topology perspective and also from a municipal policy perspective, I wonder what would lead to an entire town being wired through a school like that. Do you have any insight?
So in California, our school districts and our city governments are separate. Like the school districts overlap with the towns usually, but sometimes there's like the district that our high schools are in, where I live, is across two or three towns.
Okay.
Where the elementary schools district is one town.
Interesting. Yeah. I think back home it was one-to-one with county and school districts.
Yeah. So like in Tennessee, when I was a kid, the city network and the, I mean, when I was a kid, they didn't have a network, but when they put a network in, the city network and the school system network overlapped. So my guess is it's a place where the cities are directly funding the school districts rather than just contributing to the school districts along with the county and other places.
I see. Actually, I shouldn't get off on this tangent, but we actually had county and city schools in the same county. Did you ever have that?
Like yeah,
there were four high schools, three of them, including mine, were part of the county school system. And then the odd one out was its own kind of city school. It was a weird system.
So we had the same thing. I ended up going to the city school, even though I lived in the county because the county schools were bad.
Yeah.
Sorry, Brad. Network loops happen when you plug a switch into the same switch or another switch connected to the switch.
Okay.
And basically what happens is it creates a positive feedback loop so that packets that are trying to go out one port come back in the other and keep going in and loop. A broadcast storm is what happens when this happens and it messes up overall traffic on the network. So the loop, most switches are supposed to detect loops and just ignore them. Especially in the modern era.
I don't think she didn't mention when this happened, did she? I wonder if this is something that was much more of a danger. Some number of years ago.
I mean, look, in the days before managed switches, when the 90s, when you'd buy it, when everybody's running 10 base two, because 10 base T switches cost $500.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure it was back then.
Used to have to worry about, God, what was the purpose of a crossover cable? I'm trying to think like all the things that used to be a problem that have been kind of automated or smoothed over.
Yeah. So crossover cables. So Ethernet cables are four twisted pairs. So eight total wires. You use two of those pairs for Ethernet. A normal Ethernet cable bridges pair one and the one and two, or I can't remember the actual split, but two pairs go straight through. With the crossover cable, you flip the pairs on
They're
one
swapped,
end.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that the transmission pair and the receive. So basically one pair of those cables is a transmission pair. One pair is a receive pair. On a crossover, on a normal cable, they go straight through and the switch does the transmission and receiving flip flopping. On a crossover cable, you do it yourself and then you can just plug two Ethernet cards into each other.
Yeah.
But on modern Ethernet cards, they all just detect and adjust no matter what cable you plug in.
Yeah. The upshot is a lot of that stuff has been, you know, smoothed over for the user.
The thing that bums me out about this email is that this shouldn't have been a situation where somebody had to cover for someone else. Like, this is the kind of human error that their setup wasn't right, or else it wouldn't. If this did happen in the modern time, this shouldn't have happened, right? Yeah. Because the loop should have been detected and it should have just stopped paying attention to itself unless it was cross switches or something. Obviously, people get upset about downtime and mistakes, but like, this was an honest mistake and not a malicious like, if you yell at people for making honest mistakes, you're just making problems worse. You're not helping things. So don't yell at people for fucking up.
Yeah. Crap. I had an email and I totally lost it. I have to find it again. Here we go. We'll dip in and out of some of the horror stories. We've got a bunch of those, but intersperse a few other things here. Here's one from Daniel. In an email that he titled "The Internet Cartels." So he sent along as a kind of precursor to this a story on Ars entitled "Cox Slows Internet Speeds in Entire Neighborhoods to Punish Any Heavy Users."
Yeah, Cox sucks. They're a bad ISP. Yeah.
I don't know what region. Are they
Canada?
Regional? Okay. Well, this is from Florida, Gainesville, Florida.
I'm thinking of Charter. Anyway, okay. I'm thinking of Rogers. Used to be bad.
Okay. They're all bad.
All ISPs suck. That's the TLDR, except for Sonic. Sonic except rules. For
mine is great. But
Dane, if you want to bring Sonic to Pacific, I'll sign up tomorrow.
We should try to get Dane on the podcast sometime.
We'll give you free ad spots on the tech. We don't even do ads on the tech pod. I like Sonic so much, I'd give him free spots.
It is that rare company that's like so good to you that you want to evangelize for them. Anyway, yeah. I sometimes feel crappy talking about how great they are because you're totally subject to your geography, whether you can actually benefit or not.
You know, the thing about Sonic is it's a small company and they grew over a long period of time. And like, there's no reason somebody couldn't start that kind of ISP in other places.
Yeah.
Yeah. That have like a lot of people living in a concentrated downtown area.
Yes.
Like Sebastopol.
Yes. All right. So basically the upshot of this story is that Cox is apparently implementing a policy where, like, if one person is consuming way too much bandwidth, they just throttle the whole surrounding area, which seems insane.
I would probably raise hell about that.
And specifically, this was the specific example they gave. This is a user who is paying the $50 a month surcharge for unlimited data, and they are still throttling the whole area, which seems insane.
The whole node. That is some grade A horse shit.
This says that his usage was ranging between 8 and 12 terabytes a month, which
Jesus Christ.
That is a lot. Like, I'm not even going to speculate about what would be consuming that much data.
Look, COD patches are getting smaller.
That's true.
Yeah.
Maybe he runs a farm of PS4s in his basement that they do LAN parties on or something. Yeah, you have to patch all those Call of Duty installations over and over.
He's a professional Call of Duty player, and every 3 days it's 85 gigabytes from Blizzard.
Yep. That's just the math.
Yeah.
Anyway, regardless of like what you feel about his data usage and what constitutes unlimited, et cetera, like punishing the whole neighborhood seems like an insane policy. And also we're talking, let's see, they were throttling upload speeds down to 10 megabits as part of this. Yeah, it's weird. Cable companies are bad, man. Anyway.
I have not liked the cable company for a really long time. I think a lot of people share that feeling.
Yes.
The fact that as soon as the coronavirus lockdown started, they're like, well, we're going to throw out the download caps, the bandwidth caps for the next 3 months because, you know, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And I mean, in fairness, congestion during the daytime when people are working and doing Zoom calls all the time on like meant that kids were dropping off of my daughter's Zoom calls constantly early on while Comcast was cranking up their capacity. But like all of this stuff is horse shit. Bandwidth caps are horse shit.
Yeah.
Like punish, to be clear, 8 to 12 gigabytes, it seems excessive to me.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, in a perfect world, I'd say go get a different ISP, but your alternative is probably a 20 megabit DSL connection.
Yeah.
And like, that's not great either. So,
yeah. So here's Daniel's question as a follow-up to that article. It really surprised me that Cox was so limited with upload bandwidth. Like I said, they throttled it to 10 megabits, but it sounds like their plan, even stock, was only 35 megabits up. So his question, what is the main difference between the situation in the article and symmetrical service that allows full bandwidth up and down? Is it mostly hardware or is there some other bottleneck? I don't think I've ever come close to a threshold on upload. Most everything is just download these days. I won't rant about how Cox handled the situation and how they don't specify what is excessive. I've already mentioned that my impression of all ISPs is that of a criminal enterprise.
The DOCSIS spec, as I understand it, lets the cable provider allocate bandwidth however they want. So if you're on the latest like DOCSIS 3.1 or 3.2 or whatever it is, you can get a symmetrical connection. But since most ISPs don't pay for a massive amount of upstream, they don't actually enable that.
Yeah.
The older versions of DOCSIS were less symmetrical. So when I first signed up for the Comcast gig service, I was getting 35 megabits up and like 850 megabits down. But my understanding is that sometimes that's also because they run one channel on one spec. So like the download will be DOCSIS 3 and the upload will be DOCSIS 2.0. Oh,
interesting. Interesting. I was going to ask if you have any idea if the bandwidth up and down is a zero sum situation, like the more up you use, the less down you have to work with. Is that the case or? Are they completely separate?
I don't know. Hmm. I don't know. I would assume so on cable where it's all shared frequency, but I don't know.
Okay. When I got the Sonic gigabit, it started, I think the upload was like 100 megabit when I got it. And then after 6 months or a year, they just kind of randomly increased it to symmetrical. It went to a gigabit upstream.
Like, it is so nice. When I was still at Tested and had the fiber, it was so nice doing uploads, video uploads, and seeing, like, seeing how fast YouTube could ingest video.
Oh, yeah. Dude, right? Yeah. I never really cared about having that massive upstream until this work from home situation started. And suddenly, when I'm having to upload 10, 15 gigabyte video files, it sure is nice having all that extra upstream.
Well yeah. I mean, when we were doing so... When we were, because it tested, we were doing long videos, we were doing podcasts and stuff. Like a episode of This Is Only a Test would take me overnight to upload at 10 megabits.
Right.
Like, and yeah.
Like, yeah, we're talking some situations here. Like, it's a difference of, you know, a couple of hours in how fast something gets up on the website, just based on how fast people can upload stuff. My impression of upstream limitations on most consumer internet plans, or why they're so constrained compared to download. I mean, obviously people need download more than upload for the most part, but my assumption is they just want to push you to a business plan. If you really need upstream, it's like, it's a specialized enough thing that they want to lock you into some $200 a month, small business plan to get that.
I think that's right. I think downloads are what people crave. And if you need uploads, then they know that they have you and you're hosed.
Yes, that's exactly what my thought was. The work from home situation has really exposed how variable that stuff is.
You're a force multiplier, Brad.
Yeah,
your fancy fiber connection, because I think you're the only one on Giant Bomb that has.
Jan got it. Jan got it. And Alex just got a different. I don't know what his provider is in New York, but he also just got gigabit.
Yeah, so like, if you have gigabit and you work with video or any large files at all, then yeah, you should get a raise.
Yes,
that's what I'm saying.
Maybe they should pay for my internet connection.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
I have definitely ended up running production on some stuff just because I have the bandwidth to handle it. So
yeah,
But some people on staff are just kind of screwed by their location and what they have access to.
Welcome to America.
It's really unfortunate that there's not a better way to work around that stuff.
The market will find a solution for this.
That's right.
Won't, because it's really expensive to roll out infrastructure.
I'm sure.
And the last 30 years have taught us that it will not at all.
I'm sure. So. Yeah. This problem will just self-regulate out of existence. Right. All right. I wasn't going to take this one until you said we should, because you know what some of the stuff is.
Throw in the shade.
I was not familiar enough with this topic to talk about it, but it's from Llewellyn.
Oh yeah, this is a good one.
I am a mechanical engineering nerd, and I have designed and built multiple Lego mechanical computers. One of them had the same mechanism as the Curta calculator. My flagship computer, not built yet, is built of rotational logic gates. It would be able to compute 52-digit numbers with long operations that are based on the basic operations. In other words, combining multiplication operations to work with index laws.
Wow.
My question is, if given the choice and a job where it is suitable, would you use a mechanical computer for your work? This question is based on the fact that mechanical computers are generally easier to learn the code for, as they are usually based on punch cards or pegs that use a simple binary of hexadecimal system. This can make them easier to use for jobs like accounting and other maths-based jobs.
Probably not, but I think they're cool.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you knew what a Curta calculator was, and I don't, and that's why you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, so a Curta calculator is a thing that's about, I don't know, they're cylindrical, and they're basically like, they are from the time between slide rules, but before electronic or even like, before like electronic calculators came to prevalence in the 70s. And basically you can rotate it and it'll do the calculations for pretty complicated math, depending on the one you have. Like, I think it can do square roots and stuff like that even. And it's all like clockwork inside. So
sure.
Like if you know the history of computing at all, the Babbage engine is the famous example. But basically this guy was like, hey, look, They designed computers that used cogs and wheels and things like that. We just didn't have the capability to manufacture the hardware precisely enough that they worked.
Yeah.
And Babbage, in the 1800s.
Yeah. I was going to say Babbage, but that was like late 1800s, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you know, in that regard, like Ada Lovelace and a lot of those people were doing the foundational work that for what became the Silicon Microprocessor 100 years later.
Yeah.
A really long time ago. So people have made some incredible mechanical computers. There's the Lego ones that Llewellyn was talking about are amazing, and there's boatloads of YouTube videos that show them.
I was just going to say, I didn't look into it, but I'm sure there is a thriving YouTube subculture of people making this stuff.
Well, and they're neat because they illustrate the points. They illustrate how the computer works, I think, much better than trying to imagine electrons moving through MOSFET gates and stuff like that.
That's a good point. Like, you know, the microprocessor has become such a black box. It's just you can't look at it and understand what it's doing anymore. And this is a way to actually visualize and get your hands on that stuff.
Well, then the other thing that's interesting that's happened in the last couple of decades is that as manufacturing capabilities have gotten incredibly precise, people have made working Babbage engines. So like Babbage was never able to get it built because he couldn't get the money and he couldn't make the things work because they couldn't machine gears and cogs at the, you know, thousandth of an inch precision required to make the machine work. But there's one at the Computer History Museum that they run occasionally.
Huh.
And it's amazing because it's like this, it looks like an enormous engine with all these cams and rods and stuff moving around and clicking and clacking and making all sorts of good noise. And then it does like, you know, 69 times 420 and it gives you the answer. Sure.
Is that like the ultimate steampunk fantasy, a world where the integrated circuit was never created and instead they just kept machining the mechanical parts of those things smaller and smaller to create computers that could continue to shoot steam out and make a bunch of noises and have grease coming out of them.
Yep. We're going to need 4 pounds of coal to do this calculation.
Yep. Yep. Man, the thermal design on this thing is a real,
this one's TDP is a smokestack. there are interesting applications for mechanical computers, right? Cause there are places where EM interference prevents normal computers from working well and things like that.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think we're going to make space probes that have mechanical computers on them. Cause it seems like it's way more stuff to fail.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is an interesting, like, no, I don't want to use mechanical computers ever again. Yeah. We used to do mechanical, like my grandfather collected mechanical adding machines because he thought they were really cool. And he assumed that they would come back at some point because he didn't understand computers at all. But I got to play with them a lot as a kid and it was really fun.
Yeah.
But no, I don't need more mechanical computers in my life.
Yeah, I get it.
Novelties and teaching. I think they're great teaching tools. It's totally, like using Minecraft to build registers for computers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically just physical this would have been way better to bring up if I could remember what the stuff in Minecraft was called. The redstone?
Oh, redstone.
Redstone. Yeah. Just like a physical version of redstone.
Exactly.
Last random tangent I'll bring up about this. I was watching, I can't remember what the Twitch channel is off the top of my head. Somebody brought it up on the Discord a few weeks ago. It's like old computer
channel
or something like that on Twitch. It's just a channel. I think they're just pulling from like archive.org. It's where I became aware of the Computer Chronicles.
Oh, yeah.
But they go way back further than that. We're talking stuff from like there's material on there from like the 60s. A video came up. This was probably, if I had a guess, like directly post-World War II, like maybe early 50s, just based on the quality of the footage. I'm kind of guessing here. But it was like
Prelinger footage?
What's that?
You think it's Prelinger footage?
I don't know. But it was footage of basically battleships calculating like kind of heavy gun trajectory, like shelling trajectory type stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that caught my attention was they were using the term computer, except that it was by computer. They meant a large mechanical contraption the size of like a washing machine with like 4 sailors running around pulling levers on it and stuff like this. But the narration was talking so glowingly about like the computer is capable of blah, 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 and talking about how like precisely they could sight in their weaponry and stuff like that. Well, it was just an interesting, like different application of the term computer from 60 years ago than you're used to.
Do you know the history of that?
Specifically?
So prior to having mechanical computers could do that, a computer was a woman who sat in a room and was really good at doing math.
Oh, like computer was a job description or a job title?
Yeah. So I think Mary Robinette Kowal, who's a dear friend and writes the Lady Astronaut of Mars books that won the Hugo and the Nebula last year. Calculating Stars, wrote a book about computers, and she described a computer in the 40s and 50s and 60s as somebody, if men were good at math, they went into engineering, and if women were good at math, they were computers. Yeah. So like in the 60s at NASA, even when we were doing this is what Hidden Figures is about, is the women who were doing the math that got us to the moon. So when they're like, we need to figure out what the burn is for this particular orbital insertion to move from Earth to the moon or whatever, then there were 15 people sitting in a room doing that math as fast as they could and all comparing notes to make sure they all got the same answer. And then they would send that up to the people in the rocket to tell them where to aim and how long to fire the rocket for.
Yeah.
That's what my grandmother did before the war.
Wow. Yeah.
She calculated log tables for artillery strikes.
I started to go off on another tangent, but we'll never get to more emails if I do that. Maybe I should save it for later. It's about calculating orbital trajectories and stuff. But
ooh, Kerbal Space Program made me understand that stuff more than anything else I've ever done.
Okay, I'll just get into it because I already said too much about it.
Yeah.
I was reading an old article about, this was from 4 or 5 years ago. It was a probe that they landed on an asteroid, or maybe it was a comet.
Oh, the Japanese one?
I forget which one it was, actually. It basically intercepted it after, you know, the probe orbited the sun for like a year and then intercepted whichever object it was and actually took a sample and then returned to Earth. Or maybe it's still returning to Earth. This article is like 4 years old.
It's still on its way back.
I actually don't know if it's gotten back yet or not. But the thing that occurred to me, like I've always thought, like I cannot believe that they can launch a probe that has a transit time of multiple years and hit the thing that they're trying to hit. And I finally realized the reason that that stuff seems so baffling to me, because I know the math is incredibly straightforward, right? Like the math has been understood for centuries, right? To calculate that stuff, like since Newton, right?
More or less.
I think it's there. To me, it's baffling because there's so much room for error in the mechanical aspect of executing that math. Does that make sense? Like to me, it's like once the object is actually in motion, like you can apply thrust as precisely as possible. You can change attitude like to the highest precision you can. But it just seems like there are so many variables of things that can go wrong there that like, regardless of how correct your math is, it still blows my mind that they can actually execute on it that well.
Well, and you also have to remember, like with that stuff, there's no, like a lot of what they get back. So we did a thing with at one of the tested stage shows where we built, we made an RC car work with time delays. So like you would send it a command, we made it work the way that JPL controls the Mars rover, right? The Curiosity. And you'd send a command and then have to wait a minute for the thing to go. And if it was on like a you assume it's going to drive, if you say, tell it, hey, drive 10 meters, you know, the wheels are going to spin enough for it to drive 10 meters. But if the surface is slippery or hard,
yes,
it may go further or less than
that's,
that.
That's exactly the type of stuff I'm talking about. Like yeah, there's, same, it seems thing. Like there are so many practical points of failure, even though your plan is perfect.
Yeah. Well, and like on Mars, it's easy because they can look at the camera and they can see, oh, we only went 9 meters. Why did that happen?
Right.
But if you're in the cold, dark void of outer space, like, you know, they use sextants to tell to tell where they are and where they're going and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So
it just, you know, it just seems like to me, like at any point, if your attitude is off by a tiny fraction of a degree, that would be enough to screw things up down the line.
Well, and it's also stuff like if the engine takes, you know, a fraction of a second longer than you expect to go, then you're going to have more momentum than you expected. So, but they constantly adjust.
Makes sense. Like maybe it's just a matter of having an insane amount of instrumentation and just watching every variable constantly. And maybe they correct for way more behind the scenes than we know.
Yeah. This is why when there's two people out on a spacewalk on ISS, there's the Capcom that talks to them, but then there's also another 3,000 people in a pyramid structure that are thinking about what they're doing at that moment. So you have the full weight of thousands of brains on every single wrench turn every time a astronaut is bolting something on the outside of the space station.
Yeah, that provides a little more context for sure. All right. You want to do a couple more disaster stories?
Yeah, I like a good nightmare.
You like some good Schadenfreude? you like somebody else's nightmare.
Look, so the reason I like these stories isn't because I like human suffering, although, I mean, yeah. It's because this is how we learn, right?
Yeah.
You learn by, we tell these stories to each other. And this is a thing nerds have always done as long as I've been around nerds. We tell these stories to each other so that we don't make the same stupid mistake that somebody else did.
Yeah. This sounds like an excuse, but that's genuinely how I look at like problems and breaking stuff. Like every time I break something, yes, it sucks to have to fix it, but also like you learn why it broke and how to fix it and how not to do it again.
Every mistake is a learning experience. It's only a mistake if you don't learn.
Right. Yes. That's a good way to look at it. I should write that down. That's a good episode title.
I got it.
All right. You ready for another email?
Yeah.
Here's one from Matt. Back in the fall of 2002, I was a college senior slogging through an analytical chemistry lab. In this particular course, we were required to turn in printed copies of our lab report for that week's experiment by 5 p.m. each Thursday afternoon or risk a failing grade. Being 2002, everyone wrote and printed their reports in the department's computer lab, which for all the things it did have, lacked networked printers at the time. About once a week, usually around 4:45 on Thursday, someone would invariably save their 20-plus page Word document and eject their 100-megabyte zip disk containing said document to take to the printer's computer without first closing the file.
Oh!
You have your face in your hands. Yes, we're all getting flashbacks from the university computer lab.
Oh, God.
While the file would still appear on the disk, it was irreparably corrupted. The glimmer of hope from the still open document on the PC also turned to darkness as that collection of bits was also corrupted and could not be saved as a readable file. The act of pressing that little round button on the front of the PC to eject that least floppy of disks sent so many in the class through the stages of grief at lightning speed. When they hit the final stage of acceptance, they realized that they'd better grind out a couple of measly paragraphs to salvage a handful of much-needed points. Warnings were everywhere, starting on the first day of class and repeated endlessly, but it happened regardless. From my classmates' experiences, I learned to never trust portable media to hold the sole copy of anything of value. A few years later, my PhD dissertation lived on no fewer than 7 forms of media.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's rough. Also, on top of that calamity, think about the bottleneck of having like a single machine that could access the lab printers and all of those people trying to print at 5 p.m.
We use zip disks a lot when I worked at the university because they held 100 megs. And like we were definitely at the time when like image files would be bigger than a floppy disk, but people didn't know how to use the network server. And I can't remember if it was zip disks or the SciQuest version, but one of them was really sensitive to drops. So if you dropped the disk in a specific way, like I don't know what happened, whether the heads crashed inside the platter or if like just the little magnetic bits that aligned on the platters fell off or something, but you would just basically format a drive by dropping it on its end.
Ooh.
And this is a bad time.
That sounds like a design flaw to me.
The thing that always strikes me about the multiple copies on different forms of media is that I always would have horrible versioning problems because we would do that at the magazine. We used Jazz drives and those big SciQuest drives for the first few years I was there before the network storage was big enough to hold the magazine and be reliable. And that's it. I don't know, man. Dropbox is real nice for that stuff, I guess.
Yes, it certainly is.
Yeah.
A lot of backup options these days. Oh, man, that's giving me computer lab flashbacks.
Ugh.
I spent so much time in the computer lab at my school because despite going to a state university with a massive engineering program.
Yeah.
And despite being a gigantic computer nerd, I ended up in one of the 3 dorms on campus that did not have any network wiring of any kind.
Oh,
so while all my friends were playing Quake with the lowest of pings, I had a 28.8 dial-up connection in my room. So yeah. I mostly hung out in the computer lab instead. I think there were Spark stations.
We had with the reflective mouse pads.
I can't remember.
So so in order to get access to the Spark lab, you had to be in the CS program, which meant you had to be taking some CS class.
Okay.
So I signed up for CS 100 or 101 specifically to get access to that machine so I could play Doom on it.
Nice.
And then I made friends with the admin for the lab, And he was like, oh, we're putting in a Linux lab upstairs. You can come play there. They'll have 3D accelerators. You can play Quake. And I was like, wait, you're doing Linux with 3D accelerators? Okay, I'll come up and hang out. And yeah, that's pretty good.
That's a good friend to have.
Yeah.
I guess that was Solaris. All those machines were running. It was my first real Unix experience. I learned how to play MP3s from the command line and was very proud of myself.
The thing that always struck me about those Sun machines was they had these laser mice, but in order for the laser mouse to work, like it wasn't like a laser mouse where the laser was illuminating the surface and then there was a camera. It was a laser mouse where the laser was bouncing off of a specially textured mouse pad.
Speaking of design flaws.
Yeah.
Seems like a bad idea.
It's, you know, what are you going to do?
Let's see here. So many to choose from. There's a short one from Josh, JSchmuck2 on the Discord.
Ooh, okay.
Just after the new RTX cards were released, I picked up a gently used 1080 Ti for a great price to replace my 980. It was a stopgap upgrade to my 2500K machine built in 2011. After I put in the card, every now and again for a week or so, I would notice a very slight burning smell. So slight and fleeting that I even questioned if I was smelling it at all. Eventually, I figured out what it was. The new card was drawing significantly more power than the 18 gauge power cable I was using could handle. The insulation was slowly melting and the cable was cooking itself from the inside out. He includes some pictures here. The PC was fine and save a bad smell and some melted carpet fibers, which thankfully live behind a desk. I replaced it with a 14 gauge cable and it was fine after that, but it was definitely a tense couple of minutes. The lesson here is to make sure you use the cable that comes with your power supply.
Wow.
I guess that makes sense, but I didn't realize that like 18 gauge sounds pretty heavy to me.
Well, 18 gauge is smaller.
Oh, I know that.
Those are the floppy ones for monitors. Those are the little ones.
Huh.
It's funny, the old PC Power and Cooling power supply is the big one. When you bought like a 1200 watt power supply from them, which is pretty close to the theoretical maximum you can get. I think the theoretical maximum you can get on a 15 amp circuit at 120 volts in the US is 1600 watts, which means like that 1200 is probably about what you're going to get out of the wall ever on a circuit that has other things plugged into it.
Sure.
And the PC Power and Cooling power supplies had like their power cables were the same three prongs, but they were keyed, so you couldn't plug in a normal cable to it.
That's smart.
Yeah, and I guess this is why I never thought about it before. But
yeah, I've also never thought. Holy cow. You know, we just talked. I guess it was on our disaster episode that we talked about. Don't mix and match the modular cables from different power supplies.
Yeah, no, don't do that at all.
But I never thought about mixing and matching the three prong cable. I guess most power supplies are not going to pull that much current, right? So it's probably not a big deal. But I have not been the best about keeping track of which three prong cables go with which devices. I hope.
Yeah, if you're using newer CPUs, it's probably less of a problem, especially if you don't have like if you have a bunch of hard drives. I always worry about that because they draw, especially when they first spin up in the morning.
Yeah.
But holy cow. Yeah. If you smell a burning smell, you should investigate that immediately. Burning smells are not anything the lesson we're learning from Josh's mistake here is that if you smell something burning, figure out what it is before the fire rather than after.
Yes. As soon as you smell the burning smell, maybe turn everything off.
Like electrical burning smells are one of the few things that gets me to stop doing literally anything I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And start sniffing around the house.
That is a 5-alarm situation for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. How about maybe one more here?
Yeah, I think we got one more probably. Maybe two. I don't know. For a short one.
Trying to find. Oh, this is a good one. It's sort of in this category. This person didn't request to be anonymous, but since they name their company, maybe I should play it safe. Yeah,
don't get anybody fired.
Okay. This person starts with quick tech horror story. The electrical. Yeah, it's fine. I'll say their company name since I'm not naming them. It's fine. It just feels weird to even out the people that they work for, but here we are. The electrical engineer on my team at Intel would regularly lean over an open piece of hardware, usually a PC, and short stuff out with his lanyard key ring. Sparks, smoke, the whole thing regularly. That's That seems like maybe a change of behavior is in order.
Yeah.
But here is the, this is what I've found pretty interesting in this email, which they describe as not a horror story, more of an FYI. I'm a mechanical engineer and I used to work on the, we talked about this in our horror story episode about CPU sockets and pins and stuff like that getting bent. I'm a mechanical engineer and I used to work on the team that made reference designs for all the server grade socket retention mechanisms, meaning backplates and heat sink springs. Those socket pins that Brad had to bend back are indeed a pain in the ass. Customers, which they describe as like Facebook and Google, so like big corporate customers, want to do away with the sockets because assembly technicians wear gloves and ruin a good percentage of the motherboards, roughly 1% to 2%, by bending pins. That must be for servers, right? For data centers, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of data centers, you have to wear gloves.
Yeah. The sockets also cost dollars to produce, where soldering a CPU to a motherboard doesn't. The reason we now have cantilever pins in the socket on current LandGrid array CPUs instead of pins on the CPU in the old PinGrid array CPUs is because Intel saves a lot of money by pushing the pins onto the motherboard manufacturers.
They sell a billion processors a year, and each each processor has 2,000 pins. So, yeah, that math checks out.
Just do the math. Let's just
get that fat pin check.
Multiplication.
Yeah, this is the Pinterest I'm here for.
That's right. That's good to know.
I got at least one or two more pin puns probably, but I'm going to stop.
Yeah, you can save those. It's maybe not the last time that'll come up. Let's see. We talked about this a little bit recently. Here's email from Mike. As I watched a man with luxurious hair pull tech items of varying age and usefulness out of his desk, I don't know who he could be talking about.
Did you get a haircut yet, by the way?
No. Well, my girlfriend cut my hair like a month ago. I'm due for another one for sure.
Gina did mine the other day.
Yeah, I saw you tweeting about it.
One of the better haircuts I've had recently.
Yeah. Does it kind of make you question your old haircutting regimen and like whether it's necessary?
I don't feel great about all the times I spent $60 to $100 on a haircut over the last 20 years.
Haircuts in this area are not the cheapest.
I mean, living wages, but yeah.
Even when I get the sides cut here at home, I'm not cutting the top and it's most of the way down the back of my head at this point.
Yeah.
It's getting there. Anyway, he's referring to me pulling all those old hard drives out and stuff like that. Yeah, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
That got me to thinking about the items in my own computing area. When should I purge old cables and hard drives that I never use anymore? Some of them have not seen use in over 10 years, but are still around cluttering up space. How do I responsibly get rid of them?
Electronics recycling.
I don't know that I can get behind your immediately answer, though.
Get rid of it all. I have two big. I was in the garage looking for my cable bucket the other day. My cable Rubbermaid. I have a big like 10-gallon Rubbermaid bin that has cables stuck on a sticker on the side. When I open it up, I look at it and I just get sad.
Yeah.
I'm not going to need those ever.
I would say use your best judgment. Don't necessarily purge everything.
Purge it all. Here's the hard, awful truth. Like 2 years ago when I needed a FireWire cable and I wasn't sure that I actually had the one with the two specific ends that I needed, it was way easier for me to go to Amazon and pay $4 to get a new cable the next day than it was for me to go into the garage and spend 2 hours digging through the cable bucket.
Yeah, but then you have to wait a whole day instead of 2 hours.
But it took 4 minutes and cost me nothing. $5 is nothing.
It's less the money and more the impatience for me. If I need something, I want it immediately. I don't want to have to wait because I hate having projects hanging over my head that I can't keep working on.
Look, a few years ago, I went through and I had bins and bins and bins of old video cards all sorted and organized. Like it's the equivalent of like Jeff's, here's all of the shit that I reviewed for video games for the last 20 years, and the holes that he's filled in his collection and all that. And I had a complete set of every 3D accelerator, starting with the 3DFX Voodoo and the ATI Rage 2, going forward to like the GeForce, I don't know, 9800 probably.
What did you do with them?
I donated what the Computer History Museum wanted to them. Okay, I gave it to some other friends who do video game preservation stuff. And then the rest went to the electronics recycling.
Okay. As long as they were to some kind of museum entity, that's understandable.
Well, but the thing is, the museum only wanted the weird shit that nobody bought. Like, they wanted the weird rendition card that I had that was a review sample, and they wanted a Voodoo 5-6000, and they wanted stuff like that. They didn't need Voodoo 2s. They didn't need Voodoo 3s even. They just wanted the stuff that's hard to find. Like, when I was at Maximum PC, I thought at some point I might go through and do a, here's what it's like to play Quake. You know, here's what Quake looks like running on hardware of the time, and set up like a Voodoo 2 and do all that. But I, realistically, I was never going to do that. It was an enormous pain in the ass. So.
Sure. Yeah. I think I mentioned I went through all those old hard drives and there was nothing much on them. So I'm at the point where I need to dispose of them.
If anybody in the audience has a hard drive capable shredder in the Bay Area.
Did we talk about that?
Yeah. I love watching those videos, man.
Like, you can, I think I might've mentioned already, you can hire, like, you can rent time. You can actually have a mobile hard drive shredder drive out to your house and do it for you. But I don't even know how expensive that would be.
So there are often, I feel like every few years I see a company that's like, hey, we're getting the hard drive shredder out. If you guys want to bring your stuff, bring it over, posting on social and stuff.
Yeah.
I've never done it, but I wish I had.
So it turns out I found the right size Torx in my junk drawer to open those hard drives. Is that the way to go? Like, open them up, pull the platters out, and like, what, drill through them or something like that?
Drill through the platters with a drill press is the recommended.
Press? I have a cordless drill. Is that good enough?
I mean, just clamp it down so you don't huck it across the room.
Okay.
The other thing to take out of hard drives is the magnets, because there are some really strong neodymium magnets in them that control the heads.
And in a, like, they are dangerous to dispose of way, or in a, they no, might be useful, they're fun to have way. Okay.
Yeah. They're fun magnets.
Okay. I'll have some fun taking a hard drive apart.
I'd watch soon. That stream. That sounds like content to me.
Yeah, maybe I should. Yeah. You're probably right.
Next month's Patreon exclusive episode.
But then what do you, I guess there's like what occasional e-waste pickup and stuff like that is the
they don't do pickup,
responsible way to get rid of stuff.
They don't do pickup where we are. City.
I think SF does like, I think you get like 2 a year or something like that. It depends on your area, but I guess just Google e-waste and disposal in your area, probably.
So for us, they have a couple of times a year, like places set up that you can just go dump stuff off. They also, at the recycling yard in our town, we can take our e-waste and they'll take it pretty much anytime. So
okay.
Yeah. Highly recommend that so that then you don't put a bunch of heavy metals in the groundwater.
Yes, please don't just throw it in the trash.
Especially stuff that has batteries. So the other thing I've been looking at lately is I've got to go through my garage and find all the shit that has batteries in it. I need to recap my Xbox, my original Xbox. Yes,
I need to open that thing up and check it too.
Or at least snip the old ones off so they don't ruin the board.
Yeah.
Although maybe I should just get rid of that thing, because realistically, am I going to play any Xbox, original Xbox games? Yeah. Like what? Halo and Halo 2 are both available on backwards compatibility and Master Chief Collection. I don't know what else I would play.
I have an old PSP and a cardboard box I found that was pretty swollen. Oof. It was like about to pop the battery cover off. The battery was so swollen. That was I mean, will those eventually rupture or?
So the only experience I have with lithium battery fires was at BattleBots when we were shooting an interview with somebody and all of a sudden the biggest plume of white smoke I've ever seen just started exploding from the robot in the background. And
I mean, to be fair, that's a pretty high stress situation for those electronics.
Well, I mean, yeah, but so the problem was that the battery had gotten nicked in the fight and it didn't get it. I think what happens is moisture gets in the, it interacts with the lithium and that's what causes the fire. And then any kind of spark or heat causes the fire. Any exposure to even the moisture in the air can cause those things to ignite. So I would be really careful if they're swollen.
Yeah.
Like I know when I took my swollen iPhone 10 in to the Apple store, they don't even service those anymore. It's not like they have a bucket of sand in the back that they chuck them into. If it goes bad,
right.
They send them off someplace where they have fume hoods to do the servicing.
Sure.
Cause the smoke is, it's real bad for you. Lithium smoke is super, super dangerous. It's bad for your lungs. It will fuck you up.
My practical advice about getting rid of stuff is I would start by getting organized. That's what I did. Like, don't just have boxes and boxes of random crap. Like, I basically got three drawers and I was like, all right, this is my video cable drawer. This is my audio stuff drawer. This is my power cable type drawer. And I sorted everything out. I went through it all. I got rid of duplicates. I got rid of stuff that is like definitely useless. But there is no better feeling than needing a very specific thing and just having it to me.
So I have next to my desk, I bought some these cheap IKEA metal cabinets with drawers. And like each of the drawers is good for different things.
Yeah.
So I keep stuff like micro USBs or whatever.
Yeah. Like some stuff like that's worth having around. Like the example, like, you know, I told you when I went through those hard drives, I pulled a 10-year-old motherboard CPU combo out of the closet that had PCI slots in it and was able to use that. The best one, though, is I needed, I guess for the first time ever, I needed a DVI to HDMI converter.
Wow.
And like, I don't know how I've never needed one of those before.
That's a keeper.
Suddenly I did, and I pulled the drawer out and went through it, and I found one still in the package, like still in the little plastic baggie.
Yeah.
And it has a Radeon logo on it, and I am fairly certain that that is a roughly Half-Life 2 era Radeon that came from.
Yeah, that probably makes sense, like a 1570 or something.
Meaning that I have had an unopened HDMI to DVI converter in a drawer for like 15 years, and I finally needed it. And it was the best feeling ever.
I'm going to, hold on, you're going to hear my keyboard typing. I'm going to go over to Amazon.com.
Doesn't matter how cheap it is.
HDMI to DVI.
It doesn't matter how cheap it is. It doesn't even matter if you can get it same day. It's still not as
here
fast
we go.
As, not as fast as
6 foot DVI to HDMI cable.
Reaching
one
into
pack.
The drawer and finding it.
Oh, well, so usually ships will be available by July 7th. So you'd get it on Monday.
See?
Well, we're in a different time right now.
I just had it.
Here we go. Monday, July. Well, yeah. Okay.
Get rid of
it's
excess
$7.
Stuff, but don't get rid of everything.
I have a bunch of old motherboards in my garage that I need to get rid of.
Well, those are that's eventually old computers are just
garbage,
wasted space. But
yeah,
adapters and cables are forever.
I think that's it for today. I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Sure.
As always, thank you to all of our patrons.
Yes.
But especially the executive producer level patrons, Andrew Cotton, David Allen, Jacob Chapel, and Kurt Brownridge.
Yes.
I think I thanked our associate producers last week, right? Because it was the end of the month.
I think that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
So, but thanks to everybody. Thanks. You know, whether you're putting money in the Patreon, which we appreciate at patreon.com/techpod, or if you are just hanging out and talking to us and Discord or telling your friends about the podcast, we really appreciate all of it.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
We have a good time doing the show, but it's very gratifying to get support and comments and feedback from the audience on the reg.
Yes. We couldn't and wouldn't do it without everyone listening.
And so our patron episode, patron exclusive episode for May just went up. Or sorry, for June just went up. We talked about projects.
How is June over already?
Right. Right. I finished my Mr. Case.
Yeah.
I get the cable that I need because I was able to order it from an internet supplier and it will be here within 2 days.
What if you just had it right there?
It's a real weird cable. It needed a right-handed HDMI to HDMI with mounting holes. It's like there were only like two of them on Amazon.
Yeah, I get it.
But yeah, so people are talking about cool tech and cool projects and helping each other with their problems and figuring out solutions.
Yeah.
It's fabulous. The Discord's really good. You can get into the Discord for $2 a month. For $5 a month, you get the special patron-only episode. Yeah. And we appreciate the support. There's 750 backers now.
Wow.
Brad, that's amazing.
Thank you.
It's a very exclusive club.
Yes. It's a good size. The Discord's a good size to, get to know people and get in on conversations, but not be super overwhelmed.
Yeah, exactly. It's and I just mute the places that I don't like. If there's areas that I'm not like doing something or need feedback on, I kind of mute those spots and let those conversations lead themselves. And then,
but I find it to be a good pace of conversation that you can still keep up with. But
yeah. Well, it's really nice because like the other way for me to find out what's going on with new Mr. Scripts and stuff is basically to read a bazillion Twitter feeds or like have long conversations with a bunch of huge nerds. So
yes. Speaking of Mister, I don't know if you saw. Congratulations to Oscar and the community for having his first pull request accepted into the Mister Project.
That's amazing. Is that the type of head thing that he posted about yesterday?
Yes.
That's so good.
Not only was the request integrated, but he this might be the first time I've ever seen this. He got the coveted like stamp of approval from the creator of the project, who is kind of a legendary curmudgeon.
Oh,
and
that's amazing.
His response was basically like, "Oh, I really like this contribution. Thank you." I was like, wow, I've never seen him be so unequivocally friendly to somebody before.
It's nice when you're doing an open source project. I don't do the code side on this, but I know I've talked to enough people who are like, it's something that Fitz and I have talked about on different projects in the past. It's nice when people are like, oh, hey, a new contributor, thanks for doing this. That's awesome. And being nice to them instead of being like, you didn't follow the formatting guidelines for the pull request.
Yeah. What's the point of this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, good times.
Little bit lives in the Mister forever now.
Yes.
So yeah, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Tech Pod. We need like an outro. We need like a tagline. I was watching my daughter play Splatoon the other day, and the girls say, what is it? They say stay frosty.
You need a catchphrase.
Stay spicy.
What's your farewell catchphrase?
I don't know. We need one.
Man, this is a lot to come up with on the spot.
Well, I was saying this so that the audience would suggest things and we don't have to think about it anymore.
Yes. Please do all of our thinking for us.
Yeah. If we're going to be like the person, you know, wrenching the bolt down on the space station with 3,000 brains behind us.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Bye, everybody.